Netanyahu is, you know, willing to kill endless Palestinians for his own very narrow political purposes.
What's some of the you know, the examples you have of where you had to actually make difficult decisions and maybe not take funding?
From the start, we do not take 1 cent of government money. Assad was not going to allow him to have that fate, and essentially unleashed every conceivable atrocity against the Syrian people.
Clearly, the philosophy of trying to shame the Israeli government, you know, has failed.
The shaming actually has worked with the rest of the world. I mean, Israel is a pariah state today. Obviously, the U.S. government under Democratic and Republican administrations has had a real double standard when it comes to human rights.
The other people may not like HRW because you have big offices in New York and London, and so they see you as a branch of imperial power.
We have staff of, yeah, I don't know, something like 80 different nationalities. It's a very global organization today. It would be another Nakba. They would never be let back.
Are we good? Okay, Kenneth, we're good to start. We're going to be starting shortly. Okay, 1, 2, 3. Hi, good day, and welcome to another episode of Unapologetic. Today, I'm very glad to be joined by Kenneth Roth. Kenneth, welcome to the show.
Great to be with you. Thank you for having me.
Kenneth Roth is probably known to most of you. He's the former director of HRW, Human Rights Watch. He was in charge of the organization for 30 years. Under his watch, which is an interesting pun, HRW grew from 60 staff to 552. And so in a very, and you know, it's quite a new organization, which I discovered through reading his book, Righting Wrongs, which we're going to basically be discussing today. So a lot of the identity and what HRW is and has become is because of Kenneth. Kenneth, I'm really looking forward to the conversation. As I mentioned to you before we actually joined, I've read your book recently, parts of it, most of it, in preparation for this interview. And there's so much I discovered about the organization. I'm sure most of our readers are familiar about your organization. And we are going to discuss, well, obviously, I think the big issue right now is Israel and Syria and Congo and the DRC and Rwanda and China and lots of the work you've done. But we also, I mean, before we actually get there, I want to start the journey with just yourself and what HRW really is. So just first up, I mean, what was, I think, you know, when you look back at your time on HRW, what surprises you about what you were able to do and achieve?
Well, I mean, I think what I try to describe in the book is how, you know, a relatively small group of people who were obviously not a government, you know, we had no police force, we had no aid packages to disperse, how we were able to nonetheless have a major impact, actually generate pressure on governments and force them to change, essentially by mobilizing information. And you know, what we discovered, you know, early on is that in today's world, every government has to at least pretend to respect human rights. That's part of their legitimacy. It's part of, you know, how they say to their people, we're looking out for you, not just ourselves. And governments fall short. And so if you can carefully document that discrepancy between the haughty pretense and the ugly reality, it's embarrassing to governments. It's shameful. It delegitimizes them. And, you know, they'll go to great lengths to try to avoid that bad press attention. And, you know, usually it starts by just attacking us and saying, you got it wrong, you're biased, you misunderstood. But, you know, in fact, we were super careful, we were accurate. And so they came to recognize that they couldn't get rid of the bad press without changing the bad conduct. And that gave us enormous power, you know, gave us leverage to kind of force these governments to change. But by the time I left, we were getting, you know, 1,000 media mentions every single day about our work. So that was a very intense spotlight. It was intense pressure, and governments hated it. So, you know, that is what I learned, that information, if carefully assembled and strategically deployed, can move governments, even though we're just a small group of people. And that the lesson I tried to, you know, convey in the book is that this is not just Human Rights Watch. You know, anybody can do this about almost any issue, any government, any institution, if you try to, in a sense, contrast their behavior with the moral norms, the standards of conduct that are supposed to be guiding them. This is something that all of us can use to try to push governments and institutions to behave better.
One of the things that, I mean, I mentioned to you just before we actually started, the thing that kind of struck out for me almost the most, because I'm familiar with your reports and I'm familiar with your Twitter account, and through the work I do, I cover the similar atrocities to what you've discovered. But I've always seen you as an investigative, document-finding entity, and I think that's how most people see HRW. But really what shocked me was just what a hustler you are, just how much work you and your teams have to do to go and speak to some, you know, unsavory characters and people in military and intelligence and global leaders, and also many, many, you know, hundreds if not thousands of victims. Can you just sort of, I mean, if anyone who hasn't read your book may not understand what I'm speaking about. So you best place to maybe draw on about two or three anecdotes to give them a sense of what I'm mentioning here.
Well, sure. And I mean, what you're describing is, you know, first of all, obviously we have to travel to the site of the crime. And so, you know, Human Rights Watch researchers are all over the place. You know, they're working in 100 countries around the world. And they're not just reading the newspaper. You know, they go to the site of an atrocity and they interview the victims, the survivors, the government, you know, all sides, and they put together their reports. So, you know, that requires a lot of legwork. We then take that report and, you know, first of all, we try to speak to the offending government. And, you know, sometimes people say, well, why are you meeting with these thugs? You know, what are you going to accomplish there? But in fact, you know, one thing that I learned is that, you know, if you are, you know, a dictator, say, you surround yourself with sycophants. You know, nobody delivers bad news to you. It's dangerous. And so, you know, one of my jobs was to deliver bad news. You know, he wasn't going to retaliate against me. I'm not a, you know, citizen of his country. And so I could walk into the office and just state the reality in a way that his aides wouldn't, and say, look, you know, this is what you're doing. We see through the denials. We see through the lies. Don't fool us with that. And these will be the consequences if you don't change. And I can just lay that out. You know, I calmly, deliberately, I don't yell, I don't get mad, but just give it to them. And that is, you know, an important avenue for delivering uncomfortable messages. And that, you know, it may not change them overnight, but it forces them to recognize that things are not as rosy as they thought. And then, of course, you know, the other thing that we do is that we go to influential governments that, you know, purport to support human rights in their foreign policies. And, you know, this could be European Union governments, it could be Japan, the United States. I mean, you know, a bunch of governments around the world. And we will go to them and say, okay, this is what you can do to help us. You know, you have influence with this target government, you know, because of your diplomatic relations, because of your aid packages, because of your military assistance. Use that influence on our behalf. Condition things that the target government wants until they improve their conduct. But of course, you know, that just doesn't happen like that. You've got to meet with the government. And Human Rights Watch, in addition to having researchers on the ground around the world, we have so-called advocates in key capitals around the world. And their job is to develop relations with these influential governments to persuade them to act on behalf of the human rights cause. And of course, I would come in periodically if there was a meeting with the head of state or, you know, something that required me as the head of the organization to step in, I would have those meetings. And that, you know, advocacy side is less visible than the reports. The media doesn't, you know, focus on it nearly as much. But it's an essential tool that we have to try to intensify the pressure on target governments to change.
Can you, I mean, just to sort of give the audience a sense of just what that exactly meant, can you just give us a few examples of actually drilling down? What comes to my head just from reading the book is how you guys sort of, you know, were very, very influential in contributing to a ceasefire in Idlib. And then there's also, you know, the meetings you had with Saif al-Gaddafi to secure some prisoners. But I mean, it doesn't even have, whatever you feel are the best anecdotes, which kind of, I mean, you know, give us a sense of that.
Let me run through those two. They're both, you know, kind of good stories. I mean, first, in terms of Libya, this was, you know, under the Gaddafi dictatorship, and Muammar Gaddafi was trying to improve his image. He wanted international investment. And so he was trying to, you know, stop his nuclear program and end his terrorism and, you know, do various things that improved his image. But he needed to show that he was contending with his repression. And in that context, working through his son, Saif, Human Rights Watch was able to negotiate access to the prisons and to speak freely with a whole bunch of political prisoners. And the only condition to that access was that we would show our findings to the Libyan government before we released the report. And so I went to Tripoli for that purpose and walked into a meeting with a bunch of kind of mid-level officials, and they started yelling at me. You got this completely wrong. You totally misunderstood. And they went through this diatribe, and I kind of let them go on for a while. and finally said, you don't seem to understand. We are releasing this report in a few days at a press conference in Cairo, whether you like it or not. And the journalists are obviously going to ask us, how were your meetings in Tripoli? I could say they were terrible. All they did was yell at us. Or I could say they were very productive and they've promised these reforms. Which should it be? That shut them up. And so they said, we have to consult with our superiors. And they dismissed us for the day. The next day, when they called us back, finally, it was a new government. You know, there were stacks of folders on the table, the files of different political prisoners. They opened everything up. They were very welcoming. And indeed, we outlined about 171 political prisoners whom we wanted released. And within a few weeks, they were all released. And so it showed that, you know, delivering a tough message to the target government can make a big difference. Now, you mentioned Idlib, the northwestern Syrian province, the last province that was held by the armed opposition under the Assad dictatorship. And that was an intense personal focus of mine and a focus for Human Rights Watch, because for a number of years, the Syrians and the Russians were deliberately bombing civilian targets. They would go after hospitals, schools, markets, apartment buildings. And the idea was to sort of drive the 3 million civilians who had taken shelter in Idlib out of the country to make it easier for Assad's army to go in and attack the rebels there. And so this was, you know, a deliberate war crime strategy by Putin and Assad. Now, in that case, we couldn't focus on shaming Assad. He had sort of little shame left. This, you know, guy who'd used chemical weapons. We focused on Putin. It was before his full-scale invasion of Ukraine. And so the question, you know, we had to ask ourselves is, what does Putin care about? And Putin cared about his relations with various Western governments. Trump was not an option at that stage. You know, the U.S. government was headed by Trump in his first term. He was not going to pressure Putin. So we didn't bother with Washington. But we focused on German Chancellor Merkel, French President Macron, and Turkish President Erdogan. And I, you know, personally met with both Merkel and Macron. I met with, you know, a number of senior ministers in Erdogan's government. And it took repeated meetings, repeated attention to the media in Berlin, Paris, and Ankara. And finally, these three leaders persuaded, you know, forced Putin to stop. And in March 2020, Putin agreed and the bombing ended. And it ended completely for 3 years. It picked up a little bit, but of course, you know, Idlib is where HTS, the rebel group, came from this past December that ousted Assad. So in essence, the bombing ended definitively. And what's interesting here is that that was a product, you know, not simply of Human Rights Watch recording this awful bombing of civilian infrastructure, you know, these blatant war crimes, which Human Rights Watch did. But what really mattered was, how do you deploy that information, not just to the media, but to governments with the clout to bring it to end? And that's what that story tells.
Can you give us examples, which, I mean, maybe when you've not been given the access you've wanted, and how that's worked and what kind of leverage you've used then? I mean, what comes to mind is probably examples. I mean, I'm guessing you face many obstacles and still do. Not HRW, not you yourself, because you're not involved anymore officially. But I mean, I guess the Chinese and the Israelis were often quite difficult to deal with. Can you give us some examples of when you got friction and people weren't willing to listen to you or meet with you, or, you know, be open to persuasion?
I mean, of course we get friction. We get friction all the time. Now, you know, some governments try to block physical access for our researchers, in which case we just use various methods to investigate remotely. And some of those are, you know, are obvious. You know, call people on the phone or on WhatsApp. You interview people who have just left an area, who get outside of the territory. But sometimes it requires sort of more sophisticated efforts using satellite imagery, using so-called open source analysis, where you look at things that are posted on social media and try to verify them. We have a whole team devoted to this kind of remote investigation to break through government's efforts to obstruct investigative access to their crimes. But, you know, separately, if a government won't meet with us, and that, you know, that happens all the time, then you've got to communicate with them, you know, partly through the media, which of course they see, and partly you just put pressure on them through third-party governments. And so, I mean, China's a good example. China tried to block access to Xinjiang, the site of its severe persecution of Uyghurs, where it detained basically 1 million out of a population of 11 million Uyghurs to try to force them to abandon their religion, their culture, and their language in an effort to just kind of eradicate Uyghurism from China. And they, of course, blocked people from getting in. Now, Human Rights Watch was able to get a lot of information out, including we got a hold of a handheld device that the police use to record pages upon pages of data on each Uyghur to try to decide, you know, which person to detain. And that was very informative to understand, you know, why does the Chinese government throw somebody in prison for so long? But then when it came to try to put pressure on them, for us, the key was the UN Human Rights Council. And the reason is that, you know, Xi Jinping cares very much about his international reputation. Because if you ask him, you know, why are you president of China? He can't say, oh, I was freely elected because there are no elections. He's got to say, oh, well, the Chinese people want the dictatorship of the Chinese Communist Party. You know, we've taken them out of poverty. You know, that's a very contestable proposition. There's no way to prove it within China. In Hong Kong, where there was freedom for a while, hundreds of thousands of people took to the street and said, no, we don't want the dictatorship of the Chinese Communist Party. So that was a real refutation. In that context, Beijing cares about its international reception. It wants to be seen as a legitimate, respectful government to sort of show the folks back home that everybody else treats them seriously. So, you know, their legitimacy should be accepted in China too. So if we could undercut that, if we could get the UN Human Rights Council to really address what was going on in Xinjiang, that would be very powerful. Now, step one was trying to get the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, at the time Michelle Bachelet, the former Chilean president, to write a report. And that took a little nudging. I met with her repeatedly. But finally, she put out a very good report finding possible crimes against humanity against the Uyghurs in Xinjiang. And we then tried to use that report to put Xinjiang on the agenda of the UN Human Rights Council. Now, this was such a fraught effort that Xi Jinping himself was personally calling heads of state, pushing them to vote with China. And in the end, you know, we lost by 2 votes. It was a very close vote. But that effort, you know, the heat was clearly felt in Beijing, and we've seen, you know, a reaction to it. I mean, it's hard to say it's an improvement, it's a change. But, you know, a lot of people have been moved from detention, say, into forced labor. So, you know, is that good? No. But it is, you know, maybe a step forward. It shows that they're feeling the heat. It shows that we need to continue this pressure. And one thing we're trying to do is to, you know, to get the UN to keep scrutinizing what's happening. Sadly, the new UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, Volker Turk, is afraid of his shadow when it comes to Beijing. He will not criticize what Beijing is doing in Xinjiang. He just doesn't, you know, no condemnation about these possible crimes against humanity against the Uyghurs. So, you know, he's hopeless. And so far, the governments of the UN Human Rights Council have not made another effort to put Xinjiang on the council's agenda, but we hope they will, because this is clearly a very effective method to put pressure on the Chinese government.
We're going to have, I mean, at some point in this conversation, we're going to have a much bigger in-depth discussion about Israel. But just initially, right now, like what friction have you felt when you're trying to investigate Israel or trying to persuade Israelis, or what have been your tactics in terms of, you know, your political strategy, not your findings. Your findings we'll discuss later, but just your political strategy when it comes to kind of dealing with Israel.
Well, I mean, as I describe in the book, Israel stands out in terms of the organized community of supporters that it has that condemn anybody who criticizes Israel. And so Human Rights Watch, myself personally, were prime targets, you know, because we were a well-known, respectable organization. Our findings were taken seriously. So whenever we put something out, they would lambast us. They would say we're biased, we're anti-Semitic, you know, all the usual slurs. And, you know, I just got used to that. The way I responded first is just to make doubly sure that we were factually accurate, you know, which we always were, that we applied the same laws and principles to Israel as every place else, as we always did. And if that happened, there was nothing they could do. You know, we found this, for example, when Human Rights Watch issued a report finding that the Israeli government was committing the crime against humanity of apartheid in the occupied territory in the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. You know, the Israeli government hated that report, but they didn't know what to do with it because it was accurate. It was over 200 pages. It was legally well-reasoned. And so its supporters, you know, did the usual things. Oh, you're biased, you're anti-Semitic. You know, but it didn't work. And indeed, that analysis, that recognition that this endless oppressive discrimination faced by Palestinians, you know, not just in Gaza, we can talk about Gaza today in a moment, which is obviously much worse, but even in the occupied West Bank, that this is apartheid, that this is unsustainable. And even the International Court of Justice, in its advisory opinion a little over a year ago, in essence, found the same thing. every serious human rights organization that has looked at the problem has found apartheid. So, you know, for me, the lesson is be accurate, be principled, and then go for it. And of course, you're going to get criticized. That's life. But that's what you have to do in order to put pressure on the Israelis to stop.
Now, when you first started working for Human Rights Watch, it wasn't even called Human Rights Watch, it was in the early 80s, and you started as a volunteer. Just who was that person? Why did Kenneth Roth, you know, who was much younger, decide to start volunteering for Human Rights Watch? What drove you to do that?
Well, a big part of it, and I describe this in my book, is that my father fled Nazi Germany as a young boy. And I grew up with Hitler stories, you know, what it was like as a boy who, until age 12, until July 1938, lived under the Nazis and had to contend with, you know, the brown shirts bullying him on the playground, had to worry that the stormtroopers would arrest his father, my grandfather. And I became, you know, very aware of the evil that governments could do. You know, my father and his immediate family was fortunate to be able to flee, but, you know, I knew what followed. I knew about the Holocaust. And I really, you know, that was a big part of what drove me to devote my life to try to prevent a recurrence of those kind of atrocities against anybody. And so that was, you know, a big part of what drove me. I also, when I was in law school, was very inspired by President Jimmy Carter, who was the first U.S. president to introduce human rights as an element of U.S. foreign policy. It had really been ignored before then. And so I, you know, felt that this was the new frontier. It accorded with the values that I had. It's a lot of why I went to law school. And I decided, you know, this is what I wanted to do with my life. Now, that was not necessarily a very practical decision at the time. I describe in the book how I, you know, signed up for the one human rights course offered by my law school, and it was canceled. So to this day, I've actually never taken a human rights course. I teach two currently at Princeton, but I've never taken one. I went into a non-existent field. Human Rights Watch, which at the time was called Helsinki Watch, had two employees. There were just no jobs. And so for the first, you know, 6 or so years, I practiced as a lawyer, mainly as a federal prosecutor in New York, and then nights and weekends volunteered my time doing human rights work, mainly on martial law that had been declared in Poland. And that got me started. I loved the work. I became known within the tiny little human rights community in New York. And when a job finally opened up at Human Rights Watch, you know, my friends were running off to become partners at law firms, and I jumped to go to this tiny little obscure organization. No one had ever heard of it. And it was the best professional move I ever made in my life.
Now you've spoken a lot in your book, and you've already in this interview spoken about the philosophy of shaming. And it resonated because as we've been covering, you know, what's happening in Gaza and many other things in my life, the war in Syria, many things before this, sometimes you do feel inconsequential. You feel like your work doesn't actually have any impact. And you're kind of left with this idea that like the only thing we can do now is just shame the perpetrators, right? We've spoken a bit about friction and shaming, but also that also draws itself from funding, right? And there's many people probably seeing this interview or maybe not seeing this interview. People don't like HRW for a bunch of reasons. People may not like it because, you know, they think you may be anti-Semitic. Other people may not like HRW because you have big offices in New York and London, and so they see you as a branch of imperial power, right? How have you dealt with being objective and true and accurate and you know, trying to be true to your mission to report as accurately as you can and dealing with funding? Because I think it's an you're not the only entity that suffers with this problem. All sort of investigative reporting, journalistic, watchdog entities face this. How have you dealt with that? And what's some of the you know, the examples you have of where you had to actually make difficult decisions and maybe not take funding?
Well, I mean, first, just in terms of, you know, is Human Rights Watch a Western organization? I mean, it was born in New York. Its headquarters are still there. But we have offices now all over the world. We have staff of, you know, I don't know, something like 80 different nationalities. It's a very global organization today. On the question of funding, from the start, we do not take 1 cent of government money. We don't want anybody to say that we're issuing a report because that government wanted us to. So we are funded purely from private sources, and frankly, not corporations either, but essentially private individuals and private foundations. And that's, you know, a big way how we ensure our independence, because we don't have to worry that the people we're reporting on might pull their funding because they didn't like what we said. We just don't take money from those people. You know, we don't take money from governments. So that's an important thing. But of course, a key part of all of this is culture. And this was, you know, an essential part of my job as executive director. You know, I needed to set a culture of objectivity. And it's a matter of, you know, first just myself articulating it over and over and over again. You know, I don't want findings that are just provocative or that, you know, prove a particular point of view. I want findings that are accurate. And let's get the facts, then we'll decide what our position is. We don't go in with a prior position. And I have to instill that in the staff. And then, you know, of course, when a new researcher comes on, there's more senior staff that trains them, that goes into the field with them initially. You know, so they understand the values of the organization and that we want strict objectivity. Then everything that somebody produces is vetted. You know, nobody can just kind of write a report and issue it. It goes through a whole internal vetting process to ensure that kind of objectivity. So that's essential. That's what Human Rights Watch's credibility derives from. And we need to maintain that credibility in order to maintain our influence and effectiveness.
Okay, now, I mean, let's move to the issues. I'm going to start with Israel because I think that's what you know, that's clearly the topical discussion, and also because of the extent and the enormity of the atrocity being committed there. Now, HRW has, not under your leadership, in December 2024, after you had left, has issued a report that's saying, you know, it's found that Israel is guilty of the crime of extermination and atrocities of genocide, acts of genocide. You've already alluded to the big reports of the crime against a crime of apartheid in 2021, but there's been loads of other reports, literally tens, if not hundreds of reports on Israel going back to the Intifada. Another very big one, which you mentioned in your report, is the report on Israel's atrocities in Lebanon. Can you just give us, you have already mentioned how you sort of investigate and think about it, but I mean, one of the things you also do is you do document the crimes committed by Palestinian actors, right? So just give us sort of an idea. I mean, if you were, imagine you're speaking to you know, someone who doesn't really have a clue on what's happening in Israel and Palestine, just through the prism of the atrocities you've reported on and investigated and the difficulty you've had in trying to persuade actors, how would you describe that, you know, the 30 years of what's been happening in that region?
Well, I mean, first, as you allude to, in the kind of Israeli-Palestinian conflict, as in any armed conflict around the world, Human Rights Watch, as a matter of principle, always reports on both sides. And so what that means is, you know, say, take the 2006 war between Israel and Hezbollah. We issued a report on Hezbollah's indiscriminate rocket attacks into northern Israel at the same time as we issued a report by Israel on, you know, about Israel, on its targeting of civilians, its use of cluster bombs in southern Lebanon. When it comes to, you know, say the Palestinian Authority, we're super critical of it for being, you know, essentially a corrupt autocratic government at this stage that hasn't, you know, accepted an election for almost two decades now. When it comes to Hamas, you know, we unequivocally condemn the war crimes, the atrocities of October 7th, 2023. You should never kill civilians. You should never abduct civilians. So, you know, we're not, you know, partisan in these situations. We call it on all sides, but then we talk about what Israel does. And, you know, one basic principle of international humanitarian law, the laws of war, you know, the Geneva Conventions, is that war crimes by one side do not justify, never justify war crimes by the other. And so the fact that Hamas committed these atrocities on October 7th does not justify Israel, you know, dropping these massive 2,000-pound bombs to decimate Palestinian neighborhoods, you know, potentially killing anybody within a radius of two football fields. It doesn't justify their indiscriminate attacks on, say, hospitals, you know, depriving Palestinian civilians of urgently needed medical care in the midst of a war. It doesn't justify, you know, shooting and killing hundreds of people who are starving and just showing up to collect food. It doesn't justify starving civilians, a basic war crime. It doesn't justify today the completely gratuitous destruction of the few remaining apartment buildings in Gaza City as part of an effort to kind of render Gaza unlivable and hopefully, you know, ethnically cleanse 2 million Palestinians. So, you know, these are the kinds of things that, you know, one has to do. You report on both sides as objectively as you can. You analyze them under the laws of war so people understand, you know, what's allowed and what is not allowed in an armed conflict. And then you talk about it, you publish it. And that's the basic work of Human Rights Watch.
We're gonna speak more about Gaza just in a short moment and speak about also how that if it can and how it ends, which is, I guess, a very speculative and very, you know, dark discussion. But just before that, just, you know, your 213-page report on the crime of apartheid, there's also many others. There's, you know, Israelis using Palestinian children as human shields, the various atrocities and all the various, you know, incursions in the West Bank. Try to explain to us what is so damning about your findings in the crime of apartheid, specifically about, you know, how people in the occupied territories have been cut off into, I think it's 165 different silos. And just sort of, I think often when we hear about crimes and atrocities committed by anyone, this is, you know, from atrocities in Rwanda to atrocities in Liberia to Syria to China, wherever it may be, we see these as acts of dark passion and brutality. But we don't see that there's a calculated part beyond that, right? And this applies for almost all atrocities. But specifically around the crime of apartheid, what can you speak to that in terms of how it's, you know, how the cruelty is actually calculated?
All right. Well, I mean, you're describing two different things in the occupied West Bank. So let me just distinguish between the two. I mean, first is the whole settlement enterprise. And many people don't realize that the settlements are war crimes. They violate Article 149 of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which prohibits an occupying power from moving its population into occupied territory. So that is the settlements. The entire enterprise is a war crime. Now, you know, you mentioned, I describe in the book, you go to a hilltop in the West Bank and you look around and you realize that the West Bank is completely chopped up, you know, between the settlements and the illegal outposts and the bypass roads. There are, you know, more than 160 little enclaves, basically Bantustans. And the aim, of course, of the Israeli government is to make a contiguous Palestinian state impossible. They want to create so-called facts on the ground so that a Palestinian state can never emerge on the West Bank. So, you know, that's the strategy there. If you, you know, ask the Netanyahu government what its preferred option is for its conflict with Palestinians, you know, maybe his preferred option these days is mass expulsion, just get rid of the Palestinians, which itself would be a crime against humanity, a massive war crime. But, you know, short of that, which is going to be difficult for Netanyahu even to get away with because nobody else is going along, what it would prefer is the status quo, endless occupation. And the real purpose of our apartheid report was to say that that solution, if you call it that, is unacceptable. That the status quo is apartheid. The status quo is a crime against humanity. That's not an option. And the International Court of Justice basically agreed with us a year ago, you know, and said it's illegal, this endless occupation. Israel needs to withdraw. It referred to the, you know, blatant racial discrimination behind the apartheid. And so our aim was to try to, you know, wipe off this table as an option, endless occupation. You know, I think that expulsion also should be wiped off the table. That then leaves, you know, this, what people talk about as a one-state reality, you know, equal rights for everybody between the Mediterranean Sea and the Jordan River. That would be fine as far as I'm concerned, but it's, you know, not something the Israelis are ever going to accept because they're roughly the same number of Jews and Arabs in that territory. So Israel would lose its Jewish demographic majority. And that leaves, you know, in a sense, the least worst option, which is a two-state solution, you know, a Palestinian state living in peace next to an Israeli state. And so I saw the production of the apartheid report as, you know, hoping to advance the idea of a two-state solution and also, you know, ending this idea of a so-called peace process. You know, because when you would point out this oppressive discrimination, you know, defenders of the Israeli government would say, yeah, we know it's not great in the West Bank, but, you know, there's this peace process and all of this will end with the peace process. And that's just a joke. You know, there is no peace process. There hasn't been for years and years and years. And so, you know, what we really try to show is that this current reality, this status quo, is utterly unacceptable. It's a crime against humanity. We need it to end immediately, and we need to talk about serious alternatives.
You've spoken about structurally just why it's such a crime against humanity. Do you have some anecdotes of just how it actually makes the lives of Palestinians, depending on where they live, just so difficult and uncomfortable?
Well, I mean, obviously, what we wrote about was the occupied West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza. And, you know, on Gaza, which I'm sure we'll get to in more detail, it almost doesn't even make sense to talk about apartheid anymore because there's a genocide going on there. You know, there's much worse happening. So I don't spend a lot of time talking about the apartheid framework in Gaza. But the apartheid framework in East Jerusalem and the occupied West Bank, they're both occupied, is very real today. And we're seeing the effects of this, say, with the settler violence, you know, where particularly Palestinians who've lived forever in their village in what has been declared Area C, you know, the Israeli-dominated part of the occupied West Bank, they're just being violently chased from their home, you know, ostensibly by these private settlers, but with the Israeli army looking on and doing nothing to enforce the rule of law. We see this through, you know, the checkpoints, where they're very deliberately, it's difficult as a Palestinian to just travel from one part of the West Bank to another. You know, there are severe restrictions on people's ability to travel abroad, you know, to bring a spouse in, to bring, you know, reunify families, to have any kind of free movement between, say, the West Bank and Gaza. So there are many, many restrictions on the most basic freedoms of the Palestinians who live under this apartheid. And that's, you know, a lot of what led us to see the discrimination as sufficiently oppressive to justify the apartheid label.
Okay, now we're gonna get to, now we're speaking about Gaza, but just sort of to start to get the conversation going. Clearly, the philosophy of trying to shame the Israeli government, you know, has failed collectively over the, you know, many years that you've tried to, maybe it's worked on small things in the past, etc. But Netanyahu has effectively evaded shame and international law in a very smart and tricky way. And I think the scale of the atrocity that's being committed in Gaza is shocking, possibly even to you who has studied this for 30 years and has studied lots of atrocities. Just what's your response to that?
Well, I mean, I think you're right that today Netanyahu is, you know, willing to kill endless Palestinians for his own very narrow political purposes. You know, this is a guy who's desperate to stay in power because so long as he's prime minister, he doesn't have to face these pending criminal corruption charges against him. The only way he can stay in power is by retaining the support of the two far-right ministers, Ben-Gvir and Smotrich, who are very open about wanting ethnic cleansing in Gaza. And so Netanyahu, for personal reasons, is committed to an endless war, basically keep fighting, keep destroying Gaza until everybody is expelled. And that's what he's doing now. So can you shame a guy directly in a situation like that? No, he's decided that all he cares about is staying in power and staying out of prison. But the shaming actually has worked with the rest of the world. I mean, Israel is a pariah state today. And when we see, you know, even Germany, which, you know, historically has just approved anything the Israeli government did out of this misguided sense of reparations for the Holocaust, even Germany has stopped arms sales. Even Germany has started to denounce what Israel is doing in Gaza. So, you know, Israel really has lost its support around the world, with the exception of the U.S. government. And Netanyahu at this stage is basically banking on Trump. And so long as Trump continues the $3.8 billion in annual U.S. military aid, so long as Trump continues the massive arms sales to Israel, Netanyahu figures, I can keep going. I got a green light. And so the key at this point is shaming actually Trump. And that is best at this stage done, I think, indirectly through the U.S. public. Because, you know, there's been a sea change in the Democratic Party in the United States where, you know, basic things like conditioning U.S. aid to Israel has now become mainstream. More and more people recognize the genocide. But even among Republicans and actually so-called MAGA Republicans, you know, the far right, there is growing disquiet at the United States aiding and abetting a genocide, you know, just directly fueling these atrocities. So Trump, you know, whose foremost concern is always himself, is not oblivious to this shift, to this shaming effect on U.S. public opinion. And so I think if we look at shaming in those terms, you know, just the ability to spotlight how Israel is utterly flouting the most basic requirements of war, it is, you know, starving and targeting Palestinian civilians, that is affecting the U.S. government. I think it will affect even Trump. It's a kind of a matter of time. And it's an urgent situation, so we're pushing as hard as we can. But I do think that the key to ending the genocide in Gaza is not an appeal to Netanyahu. You know, his top priority, as I said, is staying out of prison. It's an appeal to Trump via the American people to stop U.S. complicity in this mass atrocity.
I mean, I hear everything you're saying, and I follow the logic of it entirely. But I mean, when I think of the history of the Israeli ability, as you've just mentioned, to kind of draw a process out, as in make the entire peace process redundant, which they did over 30 years in a smart, calculated way. And also because there may be pressure sometimes. Sometimes there may be, you know, a bit of a hit on the wrist, but there isn't sustained pressure, or more specifically, there isn't punishment. Right, where like it's like, you know, sanctions, full economic sanctions, or we definitely are not going to give you. It's not just about getting the U.S. to a point where they're not giving aid, but maybe even beyond that. Although I do think just stopping the aid would be a massive, massive step in the right direction. But I mean, I hear what you're saying, and I sometimes think that even if Trump, which is quite a lot, by the way, if he eventually says we have to stop this, which I do think will occur because of international shame and pressure at some point, but at that point, how is it possible to salvage what's left in Gaza in any way? Because it's very difficult to kind of enforce a rebuild or bring materials in so that the Palestinians can have some sort of existence which isn't, you know, just living in tents and being shot at when trying to get very minuscule aid. So how do we, I mean, and I guess everyone who's looking at this and isn't cheering for Israel, which is a lot of the world, right, is kind of just confused as to how do we end this horrid humanitarian disaster.
Well, let me, if I could, answer your question in two parts. I mean, first, how do we get to ending the genocide? And then second, you know, what do we do about the disaster in Gaza? You know, first, in terms of ending the genocide, you know, I know it sounds weird to say Donald Trump is the answer to anything. Donald Trump, you know, so far is just giving a green light to Netanyahu to do whatever he wants. So, you know, I'm not naive here. At the same time, Trump has distanced himself from Netanyahu in various ways. You know, we saw this in his lifting of sanctions against the new Syrian authorities. We saw it in the deal he struck with the Houthis, which did not involve an end to attacking Israel. You know, we saw it in his willingness to negotiate directly with Hamas or Iran when Netanyahu didn't want that. You know, we saw this just this week when, you know, Trump says he denounces Israel's attack on the Hamas negotiators in Qatar. You know, we've seen it when Trump twice has imposed temporary ceasefires. He's refuted Netanyahu's false denial that starvation is underway in Gaza. So there's, you know, many indications that Trump is, you know, backing off of Netanyahu. There's no love lost between these two men. And what we need to do is to push him to the next step. You know, of course, I'd like to see sanctions, but I mean, at this stage, the key is cutting off the military aid and the arms sales. That would be enough, I think, to stop the genocide. Now, on the question of punishment, you know, the International Criminal Court has already charged both Netanyahu as well as the former defense minister, Yoav Gallant, with the war crime and the crime against humanity of starving civilians, depriving civilians of necessity. So, you know, that's already on the table. I think there's a lot more work that the International Criminal Court should do to address the bombing, to address the genocide. But, you know, that said, this is a big step. So far, the Trump administration is doing everything it can to undermine that effort at accountability. You know, it has imposed sanctions on the ICC chief prosecutor, his two deputies, you know, six judges. I mean, an outrageous interference with an independent institution of justice, you know, mainly just to try to protect Netanyahu, to somehow pretend that war crimes are not war crimes. You know, so we have a ways to go with the U.S. government. But this is, you know, the completely hypocritical stand that it is taking right now with respect to accountability. Now, in terms of, you know, what might the future look like? You know, my fear, I think the current Netanyahu strategy is to destroy so much of Gaza, to impose so much starvation, to have, you know, just this wasteland of people, you know, barely surviving with bits and pieces of food, living in tents, no infrastructure whatsoever, that suddenly it becomes humane to move them out of Gaza, to move them into northern Sinai. That's the humane thing to do. You know, nobody's fooled by that. And I think the answer is, you know, don't force people out. Everybody knows that it's a one-way ticket. It would be another Nakba. They would never be let back. So don't solve the humanitarian problem by depriving Palestinians of their homeland. Solve the humanitarian problem by ending the blockade on food and humanitarian assistance. Then there's the question of, you know, rebuilding. And the money for the rebuilding, obviously, at some stage is going to come from the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Qataris. The question is going to be with what conditions. And they seem to be insisting, I think rightfully, on a pathway to a Palestinian state. Similar conditions are being posed for the idea of an Arab-led peacekeeping or security force in Gaza, because, you know, nobody really wants Hamas to continue. But somebody's got to come in. The Palestinian Authority is discredited and corrupt. So who's going to come in? If it's going to be a combination of Egyptian, Jordanian, Emirati, whatever troops, what are the terms before they go in? And many of them are saying, we want a pathway to a Palestinian state. Now, this, of course, is anathema to Netanyahu. He's devoted his entire political career to avoiding a Palestinian state. And this, again, is where, you know, Trump's weight on this could make a big difference, because, you know, Trump for now is against a Palestinian state. But we have to recognize that Trump, his foremost priority always is himself. And if he really wants a Nobel Peace Prize, he's not going to get a Nobel Peace Prize for overseeing the ethnic cleansing of Gaza. He would get a Nobel Peace Prize for really building a peace between Israel and Palestine. And that's only going to come with a Palestinian state.
Thanks. I mean, I do agree with the trajectory of how this you know, sort of like a theory of how we can get there. I'm sure you do too. I just have lots of doubts that we can actually get there, because I mean, it's the history of Netanyahu and the Israeli state and its various governments, and especially the kind of temperament of the society right now. And also, even though world leaders are slightly coming on side, very slightly, it's just the legacy that the world leaders have given a lever to Israel to just do things as they like, I think is just, it raises skepticism. And I'm sure while you've put that theory forth, you yourself have lots of skepticism that we could get to that hopeful scenario.
Yeah, no, we're all skeptical, but I think also we have to understand things are so bad in Gaza right now. The Israeli atrocities are just so acute and blatant that global public opinion really has shifted, even in the United States. And so things that have never been possible, I think, have become more possible because of global outrage. When you see, you know, France, Britain, Australia moving toward recognizing a Palestinian state, when you see Germany cutting off arms sales, I mean, this is a radical shift. And the key is, of course, going to be moving the U.S. government. But if the U.S. government really gets on board, things can happen that have never been possible before. You know, this is the opportunity in a crisis that we need to try to find.
I hope you're right. Now, on that moment of being hopeful and kind of changing perceptions, Alan Dershowitz, and you mentioned this in your book, who's you know, one, I'm sure we know Alan Dershowitz is one of the very extreme defender of Israel's actions historically and presently. He said about HRW that it's done more to turn international community and progressives against Israel than any other organization. Why do you think he is saying that?
I mean, I take that as a compliment, you know, but it's, I think he's saying it because Human Rights Watch is credible. And, you know, all we're doing is reporting what Israel does. I mean, who is turning the world against Israel? Israel. Yep. It's conduct, you know. But what Human Rights Watch does is to accurately and credibly report that conduct. And because it is so hard to discredit Human Rights Watch, because we are objective, because we report on all sides, because we apply the same principles to Israel as every place else in the world, you know, people believe what we say. And so when we hold a mirror up to the Israeli government, you know, people believe that mirror. And that, I think, is what Dershowitz is talking about.
Okay, I mean, moving the discussion beyond Israel now. Now, there's, I mean, in your book itself, you have a few chapters on you have a chapter on Syria, on the DRC and Rwanda, China, on the USA and its foreign policy, a bunch of things. So obviously, we don't have the time to go through all of that in depth. But I do want to just focus on Syria for a while. I think we often forget just what a massive war that was. It raged for almost 10 years, but longer by some estimates. It depends when you count that we weren't actually in a state of conflict. A total 13 million people displaced, 7 million internal, 6 million out of the country, more than 500,000 people killed. If you're trying to speak to someone who doesn't know much about Syria, how would you explain just how devastating that conflict was based on the reports that HRW were able to get, you know, in a few minutes? How would you explain just how devastating that war was?
Well, I mean, the Assad government clearly felt threatened by the March 2011 Arab Spring pro-democracy uprising in Syria. And, you know, whereas, say, Mubarak in Egypt couldn't persuade the troops to fire on the protesters in Tahrir Square and was toppled, Assad was not going to allow him to have that fate and essentially unleashed every conceivable atrocity against the Syrian people. So, you know, this is a guy who repeatedly used chemical weapons against the Syrian people. He repeatedly dropped what are called barrel bombs, like in the middle of cities held by the armed opposition. he would detain, you know, tens of thousands of people, torture, execute, and disappear them. This is an utterly ruthless regime. And, you know, that's why it was so much of a priority for me for many years. Now, you know, fortunately, the HTS rebel group from Idlib moved on Damascus in December. And, you know, Assad had his, he ruled by the barrel of a gun, but nobody loved the guy and nobody came to his defense. You know, HTS basically walked into Damascus largely unopposed. And it has been ruling since. You know, obviously HTS has a difficult background. It was linked to Al-Qaeda in the past. Al-Shara, the interim president, is saying a lot of the right things, but, you know, a lot of his forces are jihadists. There have been, you know, awful incidents of violence in Latakia, in the south against the Druze. And so, you know, it's a tenuous situation, but I think it's one where the new government deserves a chance. And so, you know, I applauded the fact that Trump said he would lift sanctions against the new authorities in Syria because these are sanctions designed for Assad. And he shouldn't impose sanctions in advance before the government in Syria has done anything. And so, you know, I think lifting sanctions enables the economic development that the new authorities need to establish the kind of inclusive, rights-respecting government that al-Shara says that he wants.
Okay. Just moving a bit to USA and its foreign policy. Now, there's many atrocities, again, that your HRW have written about. And in your book, you speak about Guantanamo Bay. You speak about what's happened in Iraq, Abu Ghraib, all those kind of things. But just, and earlier on, we spoke about Trump. And my own reading, when, I mean, just through, you know, the various work I've done and speaking to many people in different parts of the world, is that Europeans and Americans have a big fixation over the extent of American atrocities based on who's in charge. So is it George W. Bush or is it Donald Trump? But often the recipients of the atrocity, people around the world, don't see it that way. They have this kind of, you know, cynical, but also, you know, it doesn't come from, it's not misplaced. That, you know, irrespective of who's in charge of the USA, you're either going to benefit or you're going to, you know, be at the non-beneficial end based on its imperial ambitions. Just what's your retort to that?
Well, you know, obviously the U.S. government under Democratic and Republican administrations has had a real double standard when it comes to human rights. And so even, you know, say Biden essentially allowed a human rights black hole to exist in the Middle East, not only with respect to Israel, but also with respect to Saudi Arabia, with UAE. So, you know, there has been this troublesome aspect of every administration, but there are big differences too. And, you know, the idea that George W. Bush would, you know, use systematic torture, would throw hundreds of people without trial into endless detention in Guantanamo. I mean, that was a different order level of violence. You know, the fact that he would attack Iraq without provocation and commit all the atrocities there. You know, this is not something done by a Democratic administration. You know, Trump today, it sort of remains to be seen. I think one very dangerous step he took just very recently is to authorize the military to essentially blow out of the water 11 people who were in a boat off of Venezuela in the Caribbean. He claims they were drug traffickers. You know, we have no idea. They easily could have been migrants. But even if they were drug traffickers, they're criminal suspects. You know, they should be arrested and prosecuted. The U.S. Coast Guard is completely capable of interdicting a boat, arresting the people, and sending them off for prosecution. And what Trump essentially did is authorize a summary execution, you know, pretending that he's at war with these so-called narco-terrorists when there's no war, there's no armed conflict. And so that step of allowing lethal force to be used when police would never be able to use lethal force. Police can use lethal force, you know, only as a last resort to meet an imminent lethal threat. That standard wasn't met. So this is an example of, you know, a very dangerous step forward that I better be nipped in the bud. I mean, there's been widespread outrage, but if Trump gets away with this, it allows him to declare war against anybody, you know, and to say, we're going to, you know, just summarily kill any member of your group because we've declared war against you. And that's a, you know, very dangerous development that, you know, this is not something a Democratic administration would do. This is, you know, a very Trumpian thing.
Okay, the Rwandan genocide happened while you were, you were the director of Human Rights Watch at the time. So obviously there's a long legacy there, and we're not going to be able to go through all the reporting that HRW did on the many things there and since. But just in terms of Kagame, right, what do you think, you know, Western leaders are getting wrong in terms of how they deal with him, in terms of empowering him or disempowering him to commit or, you know, commit more, commit less atrocities?
Well, I mean, as I describe in the book, Paul Kagame is a very complicated and dangerous figure. And what makes him, you know, particularly difficult to deal with is that there are positive sides to him. So, you know, this is the guy that directed the so-called Rwanda Patriotic Front that stopped the genocide. You know, this is a guy who has built an orderly state, you know, that has enhanced economic development, enhanced healthcare, enhanced education, including for women. So, you know, there are positive things of what he has done. But then there's the dark side. And this is what, you know, many Western backers of Kagame ignore. You know, first, during and immediately after the genocide, Kagame oversaw the summary execution of 30,000 people. That's a massive crime that he has fought vehemently to prevent people from discussing. He then, you know, supposedly in pursuit of the genocidaire who had gone into what was then Zaire, now Democratic Republic of Congo, you know, the ensuing conflict there probably killed another 2 million people. Today, if you are, you know, a dissident in Rwanda, you're either in prison or you're dead. He tolerates no dissent. And of course, his most recent set of atrocities is that Rwandan forces, along with this proxy force called the M23, have again invaded Eastern Congo, basically to seize the mineral wealth, but in the process, committing widespread murder, rape. You know, so this is, you know, a guy who lives by brutal repression, who, you know, may build an orderly state within Rwanda in a repressive way, but wreaks havoc just across the way in Eastern Congo. And I've described in the book, you know, how in the past, Human Rights Watch actually was successful in ending Kagame's support for the M23. And so 8 years ago, we actually not only got him to stop that support, but the M23 crumbled because, you know, without the support, it was nothing. And we did that through, you know, systematic reporting and generating pressure, including getting U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry and the British Foreign Secretary at the time to call Kagame and say, we're going to cut off your aid unless it stops. And it stopped like that, and the M23 crumbled. But today the M23 is back. Kagame has tried to make himself, in a sense, pressure-proof by taking various steps that he thinks would be positive for the West. And we now have this dilemma again. So it shows the need for sustained pressure, but it also shows what a difficult character Kagame is. But nobody should look at this guy and think he's this great lawful leader. You know, this is a brutal dictator who has no qualms about using violence, you know, both to protect his power, but also to secure wealth from his neighbors.
Now, human beings, the way our brain works is that we always obviously remember the more immediate things. And in terms of trying to measure our welfare, whether it's good or bad, or how we presently feel, or the things we've been exposed to in the last week or year, kind of, you know, give us the impression of that. And so based on that, a lot of people kind of feel, you know, I mean, because of what's happening in Gaza, because of, you know, there's a lot of, in many democracies, the left doesn't exist anymore. It's a version of a right government or a far right government. Even centrism doesn't really, really exist. In the USA, it seems almost a weird thing. The same with the UK. There's AI and there's disinformation. There's China that's becoming stronger and has gone through a massive and amazing economic miracle, but still, you know, is very, very wanting on the human rights side. And it's the scale of its atrocity in Xinjiang is well known. So, and you then have this prism of, you know, detailing and documenting and persuading and hustling amidst all of this, right? So over the last 30 years or so, that you, it's longer now because you haven't been the director of Human Rights Watch for almost, I think it's more than 2 years now. So the last 32 years, do you think the world is, and I know it's a very basic question, but it kind of, I think it's what everyone more or less hopefully thinks about now and then. Is the world becoming a better place?
Well, you can never answer that question in a global sense. And, you know, one point I try to make in the book is that, you know, governments are always tempted to violate human rights. That's part of how they stay in power. You need, you know, a human rights movement. You need popular pressure to force them to respect human rights. It's a never-ending struggle. You know, as I describe in the book, you know, yes, China is a major threat, but there also are ways to push back against it. You know, yes, disinformation is a huge problem, particularly, you know, when you have AI-enhanced bots flooding social media. But, you know, enough people do seek the truth, including from reliable sources like Human Rights Watch, that, you know, you're able to find the truth. And In many ways, the best evidence of that is the behavior of Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping, who both preside over these massive disinformation machines, but don't trust them. They still censor because they're afraid that their public will seek out the truth, and they're afraid that they will find it, and that that will be dangerous to their rule. In terms of kind of, you know, the global trend, I know that, you know, many people feel that democracy is in decline, autocracy is rising. I actually think it's a bit more complicated than that. In the West, in the established democracies, it's true that there is growing discontent with democracy, particularly by working class residents of these, citizens of these countries, because they feel that democracy is not delivering for them, that they're economically stagnating, that they're not respected or heard by their government. And so there is a real need in the established democracies to do a better job of serving everybody, you know, not just the elites. But if you look around the world, people who live under autocracy almost uniformly want out. And we've seen evidence of that in these huge protests in country after country that, you know, sometimes do oust the dictator. You know, they got rid of Sheikh Hasina in Bangladesh. They got rid of the Rajapaksas in Sri Lanka. They got rid of Bolsonaro in Brazil, or the Law and Justice Party in Poland, or they staved off a constitutional coup in South Korea. So, you know, we've seen it even most recently in Nepal, where, you know, a government that was highly brutal in suppressing demonstrations suddenly was ousted. So there is, you know, positive news there. Obviously, at the same time, you get governments that are so brutal that they just suppress the demonstrations. That was Iran, Russia, Belarus, Nicaragua, Uganda. But, you know, when you have leaders like Putin who are living really just by the barrel of the gun, who've lost, you know, any capacity to even stage a, you know, kind of a pseudo managed election, they just have to have these complete electoral charades where they lock up the opposition. That's not a sustainable strategy. You know, that's not an indication of legitimacy. And, you know, if you look at what happened to Assad, that's a lesson to these dictators. You know, when you rule by the barrel of the gun, nobody loves you, and your days ultimately are numbered. And so I look at the global situation and I recognize that the quest for an accountable government, a government that, you know, responds to the needs of the people, that enables people to speak out and influence government policy, this is a broad universal desire. So I think the human rights movement is very much on the side of the people. We have a battle underway. That's to be expected. You know, the people in power want to stay in power. But this battle is very much worth waging because we do have the public on our side.
I mean, when you started working formally for Middle East, HRW, it was 1987, right? And at that point, Mandela was still in jail. There was apartheid was in full force in South Africa. The Berlin Wall had not yet fallen. Iran and Iraq were still engaged in a war. The Soviets were still in Afghanistan fighting. So, I mean, you're right. It's a complicated and crazy world we live in, and it's very difficult to actually understand just where we are in terms of getting better or getting worse. It does seem like there's always countless crises that are you know, breaking out. Just final question, just not about the world and about you, but what internally have you learned about yourself? One or two things, because I know asking one sometimes is very difficult. But what have you learned about yourself in the 30 years that you headed HRW?
Well, you know, people ask me, you know, how can I do this work? Because I'm dealing with such depressing things. And, you know, part of it is I do think I maintain a certain distance emotionally from the fate of the people whose, you know, lives I'm describing, just as a matter of personal survival. But I also, you know, am energized by the work because I see that by hearing these horrible stories and conveying them in a strategic way to the public and to governments, that I can make a difference in their lives. And that's really what's kept me going. So, you know, yes, I'm dealing with horrible information all the time, but I'm doing it in a way that makes a difference. And I find that very motivating. It's kept me going for decades and it still keeps me going. So I think that, you know, that is kind of the big motivating factor in my life.
Kenneth Orr, thank you so much for your time and best of luck with everything you're doing. I already asked if I said a final question, but just what's the next plans? Like you've left HRW, you've written your memoir. What's next for Kenneth Roth?
Well, I've been, you know, teaching at Princeton. I'm just starting my third year there. And I very much enjoyed that in a sense, you know, educating the next generation. I'm still doing a lot of writing. I've been publishing regularly in The Guardian and other papers about the kind of, you know, most crucial issues of the day. I still do a lot of speaking on media and to the public. So I'm kind of doing the same work I've always been doing. I'm just not running an organization. And I'm actually happy with that, you know, because it was a big responsibility running Human Rights Watch and to not have to worry about the management and the fundraising and all those, you know, practical things, and to spend my days just focusing on the work. It's been fun. So I plan to continue this.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Unapologetic is a show that unapologetically looks at the life, times, and views of some unapologetic and not so unapologetic humans, hosted by me, Ashfaq Karim. We hope this week's episode enabled you to learn something. Subscribe to stay connected with us. Your support means we can continue bringing you more of these stories. Until next time, goodbye.